I don't know how long everyone here has been on the internet, but in 1974, the idea of when the data doesn't sit on your computer means it's either on this one or it's on that one. We have educational facilities utilizing up-to-date modern technology, but wrapped inside of older legislation.
Mr. Bromley, how are you doing today, sir?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing well. How are you today, sir?
Pretty good. We get the keys today, so a lot of stuff going on here. I don't know if you noticed my background's a little more raw than usual.
I called it. I told you it was going to happen, man. Yeah, I told you.
2 weeks.
I feel like I threw the gauntlet down.
Yeah, I think originally we said 2 weeks, so this is the middle week. It's next week where I'm going to show up pretty again.
Well, that sounds like some Canadian math if I've ever heard it, but okay. However you want to frame it. No. The middle week.
It's the middle week. This is the transition week. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's the third Thursday from the second one.
All right. Let's get to it. We got a couple bangers today. Researchers have discovered a new Linux local privilege escalation technique called Dirty Frag, which chains together two kernel vulnerabilities, CVE-2026-43284 in XFRM-ESP handling and CVE-2026-43500 in RxRPC. The exploit was published by security researcher Hwan Woo Kim, also known as Vabel, and targets major Linux distributions by abusing page cache write primitives to obtain root privileges. According to the repository documentation, the vulnerability class extends concepts previously seen in Dirty Pipe and CopyFail, but differs because it is described as a deterministic logic flaw rather than a race condition. The author claims this results in a high success rate and avoids kernel panics when exploitation fails. The XFRM-ESP page cache write vulnerability affects kernels from commits in January 2017 through a patch released in May 2026. The RxRPC page cache write issue affects kernels from a commit in June 2023 through a patch released in May 2026. Together, the effective exposure window is described as approximately 9 years. The repository lists successful testing across Ubuntu 24.04.4, OpenSUSE, Tumbleweed, CentOS Stream 10, Alma Linux 10, and Fedora 44, indicating broad applicability across current enterprise and desktop Linux environments. The exploit chain was designed to compensate for deployment differences between Linux distributions. The XFRM-ESP vulnerability provides what the author describes as an arbitrary 4-byte store primitive similar to CopyFail, but it requires permissions to create a namespace. Ubuntu systems may restrict unprivileged namespace creation using AppArmor policy, limiting direct exploitation. The RxRPC vulnerability does not require namespace creation privileges, but the RxRPC kernel module is not enabled by default on many distributions. Ubuntu systems commonly load rxrpc.ko automatically, making the combined approach effective across a wide range of targets. The documentation states that chaining both vulnerabilities eliminates blind spots and enables root access on every major distribution. The repository includes a proof-of-concept exploit that clones a GitHub project, compiles a C exploit binary, and executes it directly. The author also warns that exploitation contaminates the page cache, requiring either a reboot or explicit cache flushing. As a temporary mitigation, the documentation recommends blacklisting the ESP4, ESP6, and RxRPC kernel modules through mod probe configuration, unloading them if currently active, and flushing page cache contents afterwards. The maintainers note that the disclosure process was affected because an embargo was reportedly broken before patches and CVE assignments were finalized, leading to publication of technical details following consultation with the Linux Distros Coordination Group. I also want to add that Lima Charlie's EDR has since added a new event type called new kernel socket that can be used to write detections for this exploit. We thought this one was serious enough to go take some action.
Wow, really?
Interesting. Yeah.
All right, then.
We move fast.
I don't know what else to say for everyone here except go patch. I mean, look, if you're running one of these vulnerable instances here, I think this is like as call out as it can be. I mean, usually we have some different opinions. Not you and I, Chris, but you and I collectively have different opinions with other folks on releasing POCs via GitHub and things like that. However, you know, hat tip first off for this really cool GIF that shows exploitation on each of the various distributions that they called out, which I thought was actually pretty cool. But nonetheless, how about a one-line special for cleanup and then a one-line special for mitigation? Chris, this is like one of the most straightforward things I've ever seen. It just calls out exactly what happens. Why did we do a thing? There's an FAQ, another dirty series, which I guess hat tip to Vable, I'm assuming,
yes,
for maybe doing something additional or tagging onto a previous name. But just like a really interesting avenue, I think, of just, hey, here's how a particular thing works, right? There is a really, really intensive documentation and write-up around how it does what it does, which I think is actually really cool. If anyone out there is a reverse engineer, curious about how things work and whatnot, I would highly recommend reading through this and kind of going through the different information. I think it's awesome to walk through the mind of a developer, and in this case, the mind of an exploit developer, to see exactly how they got to where they got. And it's also a bit of fresh air, and I'm doing a quick keyword search for the word AI just to see if it shows up. But Chris, we're not here talking about someone who pointed Claude code, and I'm just randomly searching through here. You and I aren't talking about a situation where someone pointed Claude code at a database and was like, or not a database, but a data set, and was like, go find a vuln. This person actually walks through like, hey, here's why I named it this way, and here's the thing that I did. Doesn't mean they didn't use AI, but there's some really cool handwritten knowledge in here as to how things happen. So hat tip to the developer. Again, for anyone who's out there, just know adversaries are going to weaponize this thing faster than you think. So mitigate it, patch it. I don't know if patches are available yet, which is why I'm saying mitigate it. But do whatever you can to protect yourself if you are running, I'm assuming, these distributions or distributions that might be vulnerable to this particular vulnerability.
Can we call out how cool that Penguin, the Linux Penguin, looks holding the grenade?
Throwing the frag? I think that's pretty cool. That's AI.
Yeah.
That's the most AI part of this particular distro here, is, yeah. I assume. I don't know. I'd be curious to see, but it looks pretty good.
I wonder if anybody's made a video game with a Linux Penguin. That could be fun. Like a mod for one of the first-person shooters.
I'm sure. There's got to be. There's no way there isn't. There's got to be.
Asking the internet has already delivered.
Yeah, it will deliver. Just wait. I'll find one later and be like, yo, Chris, check this out.
All right. The other big one that dropped last week, as I'm sure most of our listeners have heard about, is the Canvas ransomware attack. The breach affecting educational technology provider Instructure has raised broader concerns about the security dependencies schools have on third-party cloud platforms. Instructure, the company behind the Canvas learning management system widely used in K-12 and higher education, disclosed on May 1st that a threat actor accessed and stole identifying information belonging to users at affected institutions. According to the company, the exposed data includes names, email addresses, student ID numbers, and user messages exchanged within the platform. Instructure stated there was no evidence that passwords, date of birth, financial information, or government identifiers were compromised. During the investigation, several Canvas services, including Canvas Data 2, Canvas Beta, and Canvas Test, were temporarily taken offline for maintenance. The threat actor group Shiny Hunters claimed responsibility for the attack and alleged that it exfiltrated 3.65 terabytes of data, affecting approximately 275 million users across 9,000 institutions. The group posted a pay or leak message on its data leak site, indicating an extortion attempt directed at Instructure. In response, Instructure Chief Information Security Officer Steve Proud said the company revoked privileged credentials and access tokens tied to impacted systems, deployed security patches, rotated cryptographic keys as a precaution, and increased monitoring across its platforms. The company also engaged external forensics experts to assist with the incident and response process. Security experts interviewed by Dark Reading focused heavily on the downstream implications for schools and universities. While the stolen information may not include financial records or passwords, the compromise of private messages exchanged between students, teachers, and faculty members could create additional risks. Analysts noted that the messages could provide attackers with material for secondary extortion campaigns or targeted phishing attacks. Denise Calderon, CTO at Suzu Labs, pointed out that under the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act of 1974, schools remain responsible for safeguarding student data even when it resides in external vendor platforms. He also emphasized that migrating away from Canvas would be operationally difficult for many institutions because of how deeply embedded the platform is in academic workflows. The incident also prompted discussion around long-term vendor risk management and educational technology. NSAR Seeker, CISO at SOC Radar, argued that educational institutions effectively inherit the security posture of platforms like Canvas because teachers and students depend on them for day-to-day operations. He recommended minimizing sensitive discussions within platform messaging systems, reducing unnecessary data retention, enforcing multi-factor authentication, and preparing breach response communication plans in advance. Brian Bell, CEO of FusionAuth, added that institutions should continually evaluate vendor security through audits, certifications, and breach notification commitments rather than treating trust as a one-time procurement decision. The article frames the Instructure breach as an example of how centralized cloud platforms in education create concentrated risk when a single provider experiences a security incident. And I mean, I think this is the same argument for like the CrowdStrike outage we saw and anytime a major provider of a service goes down. So no surprise there. It is interesting to see how many schools actually use this particular platform. I find that interesting how they captured so much of the market.
Yeah, you know what's funny to me, Chris, is you have all these people who are out here who are like, oh, it would be so difficult to get off this because of how deeply embedded they are. And I was like, well, it was pretty easy to get them deeply embedded in the last, what, like 8 years? I mean, 8, 10 years. Canva's not that old, to my knowledge. I'm not saying there's some organizations that haven't been using Canvas for a long time. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm thinking of something else, right? But from a Canvas perspective, like, yes, there's a lot of organizations that are heavily integrated on these things. I totally get that. But at the same time is, you know, Chris, one of the things that I'm just going to point out here, and I'm not ranting, I'm just pointing out something here, but like, we're quoting a 1974 act where schools are still on the hook for protecting student data, even when it sits in a platform the school doesn't control. Folks, I don't know how long everyone here has been on the internet, but in 1974, the idea of when the data doesn't sit on your computer means it's either on this one or it's on that one. This does not constitute and bring in the idea of what the cloud is and whatnot. So, you know, a little bit frustrating that once again, we've got schools wrapped inside of, we have educational facilities utilizing up-to-date modern technology, but wrapped inside of older legislation. And I think that is creating a little bit of an odd discussion point, because it's kind of like, well, it was your responsibility. You should have protected it. And it's like, can we look at the MSAs that we signed? Can we look at the agreements that we signed? I mean, did schools literally just say, yeah, don't worry, Canvas, we'll protect all of it for you? I highly doubt it, right? I think it's a combined effort. I mean, Chris, if this anything, this is a third-party attack any which way you cut it. And I just think that's something to be noted for organizations out there is this is a third-party attack. The adversaries compromise an infrastructure. No comment on the company instructure, but this is a compromise of third-party infrastructure that had a significantly negative outage for a lot of their customers and whatnot. And it just needs to be treated as such. You know, I find it interesting that kind of like with hospitals and schools, there's always this idea. Now comes the rant. There's always this idea with hospitals and schools where it's like, well, what were you doing? But if a Fortune 50 gets compromised, it's like, oh, the adversary was clearly sophisticated, you know? And it's kind of like, I mean, like, you know, schools are doing what they can, right? Yeah. They're leaning on technology to make it easier. 1974, the act was written, but are we including that back in March 2020 through August 2020, pretty much every school district in the United States was forced to adopt some form of online learning. Like Canvas had their heyday at the beginning of COVID. And they were like, all right, well, we're already built on this infrastructure.
Yeah.
So now what? Like, what do we do now? And they keep going. And I would turn the lens and say, hey, Canvas, what are you doing? Or Instructure, like, what did you guys do during this time? And that's just me wanting to defend the school districts a little bit here.
Yeah, it was also interesting to note that Shiny Hunters was behind this one. I know we've talked about them a few times over the last 6 to 8 months, and it seems like they're sort of expanding their target list, the different industries they're involved in.
I heard, if I'm not mistaken, I remember reading somewhere that they actually gave back a lot of data or they helped decrypt a bunch of environments. I can't remember where I saw that. If I find the link, I'll send it to you. But I remember reading somewhere that they were like, oh, we didn't realize we did this. But there's a bunch of students right now in the US, at least, going through finals season. And I had heard that a lot of people had like lost papers, lost work and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the professors were like, all right, nothing you can do about this. So everyone passes. I'm like, thank you, shiny hunters. I mean, I don't. We don't give adversaries compliments around here, but you know what I'm saying, right?
It's some of those good guy, bad guys. All right.
Like, I mean, think about it this way. Shiny hunters could have done this back in March, and the professor's like, you have enough time to redo all that paperwork. But they did it in early May when it's like, I don't have time to redo this. And they're like, all right, don't worry about it.
What a bunch of good guys.
Let's not go that far.
All right. Security researchers at Akito are tracking a major expansion of the mini Shai Halud malware campaign targeting the NPM ecosystem. The operation now impacts more than 160 package names and hundreds of malicious packages, versions across JavaScript projects. The campaign originally focused on SAP-related packages earlier this year, but researchers say the latest wave has spread into a much broader set of developer ecosystems. According to the report, the malware is designed to compromise developer environments and CI/CD infrastructure by stealing credentials and abusing trusted publishing workflows to spread through the software supply chain. Aikido says the malware has evolved from the earlier campaign. In the previous attacks, compromised packages executed an obfuscated payload during installation. The newer wave instead abuses NPM lifecycle scripts to trigger malicious execution during installs and intentionally forces installation failures after the payload has already run. Researchers say that tactic helps disguise the compromise because developers may assume the issue is just a normal package installation problem rather than malicious activity. Major aspect of the campaign is its abuse of modern trusted publishing infrastructure. Many software projects now rely on GitHub Actions and OpenID Connect to generate temporary NPM publishing credentials automatically. Akito warns that if attackers gain execution inside CI/CD workflows, they can abuse those permissions to mint legitimate publishing tokens directly from compromised pipelines. That allows malicious packages to appear authentic and include valid provenance records showing that they originated from official automated workflows. Researchers emphasize that provenance only verifies where software was built, not where the build environment itself was secure. The malware searches compromised systems for GitHub and NPM tokens, GitHub Actions credentials, AWS metadata, Kubernetes service account information, vault secrets, environment variables, and locally stored secrets. Researchers say it goes beyond traditional credential theft because it also attempts to identify packages the victim can publish, inject malicious dependencies into those projects, increment version numbers, and publish newly infected releases. Akito recommends treating any affected development or CI environment as fully compromised, rotating credentials and deployment keys, and auditing recent package publishes and GitHub action runs for signs of additional malicious activity. So yeah, this one, you know, I don't think this is the first time we talked about this one, and it's always sort of impressed me in how clever it is to keep growing a worm in the NPM ecosystem and injecting their stuff into those packages and forcing updates on client systems. Like, you can just see how quickly this would spread.
Yeah, to me, this is one of those really interesting ones here. I'm with you in that note, but like, well, what I find maybe even more interesting here is adding a pre-install hook that runs. And I'm sure for a lot of folks out there who are developers who utilize NPM, they're probably like, Matt, why is that so crazy? It's not about being crazy, folks. I think it's the adversary's ability to skip and rotate and hop through all the different ways that package management occurs, happens, builds, updates, whatever it is. And it's kind of like, there's so many different, not levels, but there's so many different points of execution, Chris, as like you load and utilize a third-party library that, you know, we continue to build out these functionalities from a software perspective, but it just gives adversaries even more and more capabilities to do a thing. Like, it's not just bringing in when someone loads a library, I'm going to run code. Now it's like, pre-installation hooks, post-installation hooks. I'm going to drop a thing inside of a thing that does a thing. We're going to write malware based off of a webhook notification that gets sent out. Like, there's just so many ways to go around making this happen that, again, we don't give credit to adversaries, but like, it's just a really interesting study, I think, in adversarial technique pivoting and to kind of where, you know, where they find areas to nestle in and run malicious code. Yeah. I got some environments I do some work with, Chris, from a consulting perspective, who had some of these issues. They were kind of like, we've kind of fallen victim to this. We've had some malicious payloads launched and IOCs hit and everything like that. And I mean, you get into things like this, you know, again, we've talked about this before, where the adversary is very aware of how like AWS infrastructure works and what that pulls back and everything. Not a fan of the fact that the end of this article is, of course, hey, here's how we would detect it and stuff like that. But I do appreciate the level of insight and depth into like a continuing problem with NPM and package management tools. It's certainly something that we need to be aware of. I will beyond a doubt, like this, we need to be very, very in tune with these things, because these adversaries are just continuing to get smarter every single time.
Yeah, I thought it was a clever little touch too, where they make it look like the installation had a insulation problem. So mm-hmm. like any noise that you're seeing in the console, you just kind of write off as like, oh, it didn't install properly. Not yeah. that, hey, it just ran all these scripts and is now infecting my supply chain.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, again, we don't give adversaries credit here. We don't give them kudos, yeah. but hat tip for being nimble.
Yeah, they're not dumb. That's for sure. All right. And here we go. Here's the AI article for you, Matt.
I was worried we weren't going to have one.
Google Threat Intelligence Group says threat actors are moving from experimental AI usage towards large-scale operational integration of generative models across the cyber attack lifecycle. In its latest report, GTIG describes AI as both a tool for attackers and a target for supply chain compromises. The company says it has, for the first time, identified a threat actor using what it believes was an AI-developed zero-day exploit intended for mass exploitation. GTIG also observed growing interest from Chinese and North Korean threat groups in using AI for vulnerability discovery, exploit development, malware obfuscation, and reconnaissance operations. The report highlights multiple examples of AI-assisted exploit and malware development. GTIG observed Chinese-linked actors using expert persona prompting to steer Gemini into acting like a senior security researcher during vulnerability analysis of embedded devices and firmware. Researchers also identified attackers experimenting with curated vulnerability datasets such as the Wuhan Legacy repository to improve AI-assisted code analysis. In another case, cybercriminals allegedly used AI to identify and weaponize a zero-day vulnerability that bypassed two-factor authentication in a web-based administration tool. GTIG says the exploit code contained characteristics commonly associated with LLM-generated output, including structured educational comments and hallucinated metadata. Google also documented malware families using AI to improve evasion and automation capabilities. Malware such as PromptBlux and HonestQ dynamically modify code or generate obfuscated payloads to avoid detection, while CanFail and LongStream contain large amounts of AI-generated decoy logic intended to disguise malicious behavior. The report also examined PromptSpy, an Android backdoor that integrates Gemini APIs to autonomously interact with infected devices. PromptSpy can analyze the device interface, generate actions like taps and swipes, replay authentication gestures, and dynamically adapt commands without direct operator control. GTIG describes this as a shift towards autonomous malware orchestration, where AI systems make tactical decisions during intrusions. Beyond malware development, the report describes how attackers increasingly rely on AI for reconnaissance, phishing preparation, and information operations. Threat actors have used LLMs to map organizational hierarchies, identify third-party business relationships, and gather environmental details about targets to create more convincing phishing lures. Google also linked AI-generated voice cloning to the pro-Russian Operation Overload disinformation campaign, where fabricated media content impersonated journalists and legitimate news organizations. At the infrastructure level, GTIG observed adversaries building scalable systems for anonymized access to premium AI models using automated account registration tools, proxy relays, account pooling services, and anti-detection browsers to industrialize AI abuse while bypassing platform restrictions. The report additionally warns that AI ecosystems themselves are becoming attractive supply chain targets. GTIG documented attacks involving malicious AI agent skills, compromised GitHub repositories, poisoned PyPI? I can never remember. PyPI. Poisoned PyPI packages and breaches affecting AI-related dependencies such as Light LLM. In several incidents, attackers stole cloud credentials and API secrets from CI/CD environments to support ransomware and extortion operations. Google says attackers are increasingly targeting the orchestration layers around AI systems, including connectors, plugins, and wrappers, rather than attempting to directly compromise frontier models themselves. The company also outlined defensive initiatives, including Big Sleep, an AI vulnerability discovery agent, and CodeMender, an experimental Gemini-powered system for automatically patching vulnerabilities. So, yeah, big, wide overview of where the state of adversary AI use is, and kind of give you a hint of where it's going. It's not good. I think the defender side of the house needs to hurry up and get better at responding at machine speed, because I think all of this is just going to automate and broaden things to the point where we need to be using those tools to fight back.
Chris, I don't disagree with you, but I thought we weren't going to see this level of attacker sophistication until Mythos came out. Mm-hmm. Seems to me like we didn't need to wait that long, did we, folks?
Yeah.
As we kind of called out, it's a tool. It's a tool that you use. I'm with Chris 100% on this one. Defenders, blue teamers, those of you who listen to this podcast and do the good defensive work, please start to integrate this stuff into your tech stack if you're not already. I can tell you on behalf of Chris and myself, we both use AI significantly every single day. We're both building stuff within AI. Like it's a daily part of what we do and how we do. It makes you infinitely faster, right? It makes you infinitely smarter about things. It allows you to address code in different ways. Yes, yes, yes. I know there's all sorts of hallucination difficulties and whatnot. And there's all sorts of things that can come about of like, oh, I'm not going to give it access to my production instance and all that kind of stuff. Then don't.
Yeah.
But use it to get smarter about things. Use it to get faster about things.
And use it to get a feel for how it works. I think that's the biggest thing. The more you kind of develop an intuition about where it fits and what it can help with versus just, you know, having this binary decision about it, right?
Yeah. All of these things. And then also, you know, I continue to see like on various social media outlets, LinkedIn and stuff like that, where people are like, oh, you know, the adversaries aren't doing this and whatnot. I agree with folks when they start talking about, oh, it's a tool. It's not a you know, sentient system that's going to bring you down or anything. I agree with folks on that one. But I'm a little bit hesitant to really follow along with the naysayers who are just kind of like, oh, you know, all this is just like smoke screens and industry FUD and everything like that. And I'm like, there's adversaries out there, and I don't know, maybe this article like probably names a few of them, but there are adversaries out there who didn't know how to do a particular thing and now they do. Mm-hmm. And that's because of AI. And like, yeah. I look at it as, okay, even in its most simplest form, can we on this side mimic that of it? Can we get smarter about how we do things? Can we get smarter about how we go about implementing defenses and different whatnot? And like, you know, run your configuration files through these things and help build a program. Chris, I've got a second screen over here. I just built out a complete adversary emulation capability utilizing AI. Now, if anyone who's like, what, you can't do that using AI? Yes, you can. Like I'm trying to let folks know it is a force multiplier for everyone. And it is a equalizer for everyone. But the folks who use it are going to force multiply exponentially faster than the folks who don't use it or kind of put their head in the sand about it. So I don't know how else to advertise this to folks other than if you don't know, you don't know. And unfortunately, the speed at which you'll get left behind is very, very like far. It's miles. It's miles in a day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally agree, Matt. Thanks for another great conversation. And before we sign off here, I just want to put the call out. If you're a fan of the show, if you're listening to it and you like what you heard, if you can give us a like or a comment or a share, that'd help, you know, trying to justify keep things going with this show. And it sure helps if we can show those numbers. So if you can help support us, it'd mean a lot to us. So thank you.
Likewise, Chris. Always a pleasure seeing you, man. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.